Me. Coming to you live from the astral corpse of a dead god, my name's Tom, and with me as always is the concept of grief made incarnate, and this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 12, Not That Mayonnaise.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I forgot my name.
So did all of the rest of us. And today, we're going to be talking about inclusivity in board games, which is a big word that I learned. Tom, what did I learn that word means?
Well, I don't know what you learned that the word means, because you spent the first formative years of our lives thinking that potato was a type of dog.
It isn't?
No. We've been through this, man.
What is it?
It's a type of dog. But inclusivity refers to, as I understand it, the idea that your board games should be playable by a variety of people, not just, you know, people that are fully ably bodied and ably eyed and reasonably, you know, clever, but also people who maybe don't have hands or have eyes that don't see color very well.
I thought it was a large winged lizard. So this won't be the conversation I thought we were going to be having, but it still seems like one worth approaching.
I'm pretty sure the way we've started this episode off is incredibly offensive and probably is going to get us just reamed out on Twitter.
Really?
Sure.
I guess the large winged lizards will be mad that I don't know what they're actually called. So anyway, inclusivity
in games.
And we'll probably go outside of board games a little bit too, but actually the reason this topic came up for me was talking to some people on Twitter who brought up how podcasts are not inclusive to the deaf, which led me into some experiments in trying to make our podcast accessible to people who can't listen to it on speakers or headphones. I'd never thought about it before, and it was kind of an eye-opener for me. And I took a while trying to transcribe the first couple episodes. And I did. If you go back into the archives now and look at episodes 1 and 2, there's a link at the bottom of each section of show notes where you can read my best effort of a transcription of those shows. But I don't know. I don't think the jokes really came across in text. And plus, it was excruciatingly painful because I have carpal tunnel syndrome. And it also took me forever. I'm a pretty fast typist, but I still, it took me hours for each one.
Yeah, transcription is a slow and laborious process that is not enjoyable for anybody involved. So for that purpose, you know, that kind of illustrates a point of inclusivity. It's not enough just to create, I think, a crude facsimile in a different form of something to make it inclusive. It's got to make sense for the form that you're working with here. So since our podcast relies heavily on, you know, inflection and voice and all of these things to make the jokes work.
And alcohol.
I'm putting heavy, heavy air quotes around the word jokes there.
Yeah.
I think that any kind of transcript of it needs to have that humor and have the topics and whatnot translated into a way that makes sense for writing instead of for, what is it we do here? Ramble?
Yeah. I think that's the kindest way you can phrase it.
And so what we were thinking we would do instead was, instead of a straight transcription, more of a summarized and adapted discussion of more of an accompanying blog post, I guess is what you would call it at that point, which the other guy promised to do, the guy who isn't Johannes, and he didn't do it.
Yeah.
So that guy sucks.
Yeah. He seems like a real jerk. But, you know, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. It may yet happen.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
Oh. I guess I'll start breathing again.
I wondered why you were so purple.
Yeah, that's why.
There's a lot of
ways. Also, I got an acting gig as the purple Teletubby. That's the other reason I'm purple.
Oh,
Tinky Winky?
That,
No. Yeah?
That show was canceled, dude. It's not on anymore.
Why am I purple?
Why did you jam a television into your gut?
Yeah, it's not particularly accessible for me.
No, you could look in a mirror.
Then it would be all, you know, mirror imaged.
Well, yep. There's just no pleasing you.
I'd need a
you.
System of mirrors.
There's no pleasing you, is there?
There really isn't.
Inclusivity in board games. So there's a lot of things to consider there. But, I mean, one of the biggest things that we've actually personally run into, because we're friends with a man named Alfonso, is designing games and playing games that work for colorblind people. Alfonso cannot distinguish between any colors at all. The world is just a gray and brown blur for him, and he doesn't even really know what I mean by that.
You know that both of those are colors. Gray and brown, in fact.
Really?
Yeah.
My teachers lied to me, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, Alfonso is colorblind.
He's red-green colorblind, I believe.
So, which led to a funny story for me when we designed the first edition of our game, Big Man, that we're working on. And one of the icons in it was kind of a salmon color.
Yeah.
And another icon that you really needed to be able to distinguish from the first was more of an off-pink sort of shade.
Yeah, sure.
And so I'm explaining this to him, and there's just this look of dawning horror on his face as we try to tell him, yeah, this is the icon that means that it's meat, and this is the icon that means that you die immediately when you draw it. So tell the difference between that.
Classy. Yeah, but even colors, those were pretty close. I had a little bit of a hard time with those colors.
In my defense, they looked really different on my monitor.
Yeah, that's the thing you run into, too, is you know, colors in print are not the same as colors. Even colors on your monitor versus colors on my monitor are probably significantly different. And that's just something you have to get past.
Well, even sometimes if you design the game in one program and then turn it into a PDF, the colors will shift.
Yeah, well, PDFs are designed for print, so they go from RGB to CMYK.
Sidetrack, is the appropriate way to shorten PDF into like a word, PUDFA?
Yeah, I think so.
.PUDFA?
Actually, that sounds incredibly offensive. Well, not incredibly offensive. That sounds like a middle school or an elementary school euphemism, you know.
Kicked him right in the PUDFA?
Right in the PUDFA.
Okay. Anyway, so that, you know, making sure your colors are distinct enough from one another is one way to avoid injuring the colorblind.
Injuring.
Is that not the word I want?
I suppose that, you know, if you're designing traffic signals, you
really
want them.
Yeah, that's pretty important, yeah. But actually, traffic signals are a really good point to make there because you always have the red light at the bottom?
See, I don't remember, and I was hoping you would know so I could bring this up, but you don't know either.
I don't remember off the top of my
head. Traffic lights always have one at the top and one at the bottom, and I don't remember because it doesn't matter because I can distinguish red from green.
Right, but I would imagine Alphonse knows because he knows when the bottom one is lit, that means he needs to stop, and when the top one's lit, that means he can go.
I don't know that Alphonse knows, but hopefully your run-of-the-mill colorblind driver can tell.
Right.
You know.
And the broader point is that you can design with that in mind so that there's two ways to determine, not just color, also position helps, too.
So what Tom mostly came up with this, we bounce it off each other, but I'll give him the credit for the idea, was in addition to having the different colored markers for each of those, and also to distinguish the color of the player tokens, this is really where it came up, was also having like a base for the player pieces that was like a star, a triangle, and a square, and a circle or something. So they're distinctly different, even if you can't see any colors. Mm-hmm. And then we've got icons and stuff that eventually will make our finished product not so reliant on telling the color of circles.
Right, right. But yeah, if you can combine a shape and a color, that helps a lot, right? Or an icon and a color, that helps quite a bit there with being colorblind inclusive. I don't know how you would make a board game, you know, blind inclusive.
I think you'd have a hard time. There was someone on Twitter, some board game developer on Twitter yesterday was April 1st as we're recording, posted they were going to have an April Fool's joke about releasing a Braille edition of one of their games, and then they're like, but I'm sick, so I can't make any of the jokes, so here's what they would have been. I don't know, like, the fact that a Braille edition of a game would be an April Fool's joke seems funny to me. I'm not familiar with the game they were talking about, mm-hmm. So maybe it's just one where there's no way that could possibly work. Yeah, I just, you know, most of it. Oh, no, you know what? I think they were talking about Dixit, mm-hmm. which is a game where you have to vaguely describe pictures, like you want to describe them well enough that some players figure it out and other ones don't. That's like a really just basic, incorrect, but enough to get the point across description of how that game works.
Right.
But yeah, so like you really probably couldn't get away with that pretty very well as a blind person.
Probably. Well, you know, one of the things I'm noticing as I sit here on the podcast making a fool of myself and think about it, I'm trying to figure how you would make, like, say, you know, a dungeon crawly game like Descent, you know, blind, accessible to a blind person. And my gut reaction is, well, how would that work if how would you know where you were putting your figure on the board and that kind of thing? But then I'm thinking, you know, blind people do all sorts of stuff in the world that I wouldn't think you could do if you couldn't see. So I'm wondering if there's just so much we don't know about the world of the blind that how would we ever know?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
It seems like we might need to do a ton of research even to begin approaching the question.
Yeah.
We've run into the colorblind question
with
Alfonso and been able to make some reasonable accommodations chatted with him about what works. I have no idea for a blind person.
Yeah. Actually, I'm sure we don't right now, but maybe one day down the road, someone will go back into the archives and listen to this episode. If you're a blind board gamer, we'd love to hear how you interface with games that have not been designed with you in mind, and if there are any good ones that have been, or that have, you know, if anyone has created house rules or, you know, third-party components or anything to make it more accessible to the blind, that it would be really interesting to know. Also, if there's just people out there who would like to play more board games who aren't able to for whatever reason, who want to be available to give feedback to game designers so they know the questions to even begin asking when they're designing, we'd love to hear from you as well.
Yeah, cause thinking about it, I really have no idea.
Yeah.
So another you know, if you're ready to move on from various ocular difficulties, another place where you can think about inclusivity in board gaming is the language. I know Board Game Geek has like a language dependency score on it, where it indicates how well do you have to know the language the game was written in to play it. In some games, that matters more than others. You know, that it's kind of a double-edged sword, because if your game includes a lot of written components, you can do a lot with that. You know, language is a powerful force for, you know, communicating ideas to another person. And we have
isn't
this
that what language is?
Yeah,
isn't
we have
the very definition of
and,
language.
And we have this entire system of marks that you can put on various surfaces to represent that language, and thus, I'm just going to keep running with this if you don't stop me. So you probably
I wish you would have stopped a while ago. But yeah, I mean, something to think about when you're coming across a language barrier is not okay. So there's the obvious, like someone who English isn't their first language might have a rough time. But then there's someone who maybe didn't have a great education, and so they're not entirely literate, or they read at a lower level. That's tough for that person. You probably maybe don't think about that person when you're designing, whether or not that person is a child. You know, you put your age, this game is for this age range on it, but it's entirely possible, and depending on where you live, maybe even probable, that someone's well within the, you know, 18 and up age range who still doesn't have the reading comprehension for your game rule book. Maybe they didn't have the education they needed. Maybe they have a close head injury. And,
maybe they
and,
just don't read well.
Yeah,
just not
right,
a skill
yeah.
that they have.
Yeah, that's true. And then there's also there's people who are dyslexic.
I can't build a birdhouse. I mean,
yeah, that seems on topic.
I was saying that it's like an example of a skill that
Tom birdhouse illiterate.
There you go. That was the point I was making.
Yeah, okay. So there are games, I think, that I don't know how many of these games really do this intentionally to try to circumvent the language barrier, but there are a lot of games out there that use a lot of their own iconography and pictures and icons, so they don't have to have a lot of text. And sometimes it's just something you do to try to save space on a board or a card, and sometimes it's not. But we've definitely had different experiences of those things. I know Tom has a game in mind.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Eclipse on the podcast before, which I thoroughly enjoy, and I think the appropriate word for how Johannes feels about it is hate.
We're talking about Eclipse.
We're talking about Eclipse, yeah.
I wouldn't say hate, but definitely not you know, not anything positive.
Yeah. And Eclipse does a great job, I think, of getting words more or less entirely off of its components. I think the only in-game components that have language on them at all are some of the reference cards.
Yeah, I think so.
And beyond that, it uses...
Or numbers. There are numbers on things.
Numbers, but... sure. But everybody... that's more universal.
Yeah.
But in most cases, everything you need to know, once you get the hang of their iconography system, is done with symbols and icons and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, makes it more accessible in a way...
I'm not sure, because so there are some things. The things that have the most iconography, I think this probably comes back to the traffic light thing. Mm-hmm. We don't have to interface at this level, so we're not aware of whether or not we could. But like all of the upgrade ship upgrades and stuff in mm-hmm. Eclipse have their own specific icon, but still have the text on them to say what they are. This is a type of engine upgrader. This is a type of missiles.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't have those words on there, I would not be able to memorize. I don't think what all those icons are different from one another. Maybe a little bit, but
mm-hmm. The other thing I always wonder about with stuff like Eclipse is, you know, Eclipse is made by a Finnish company from the Finland, and I wonder how much getting, you know, words off of the boards and mainly in the manual was to save on translation efforts. You know, you don't have to hire a translator to do quite so many documents and files and whatnot if you minimize it.
I don't know.
I've never been to Finland, so I couldn't say if that would be relevant at all.
Whatever the case,
I've heard it's lovely.
Aside, I didn't have a problem. I know it's written in English and I can read, but even in the parts of Eclipse where there's just no, you know, they do a pretty good job with your little like resource tracking,
mm-hmm.
Player card map page thing, of making it pretty simple. All you need to know is numbers and colors, and I have a hard time. What's the difference? Resources
refers to your three different types of things that you can get: money, science, and materials.
Yeah,
is the third one.
Materials and resources are the same thing in my mind.
Yeah, I don't know that he's ever not complained about that in a game of Eclipse.
Well, it's because I always say the wrong thing, and then you're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, the thing that I
that's
said.
That's because you made a mistake, and I must ridicule you. You failure.
Yeah, well, you know. It's because I can't read.
My Only Alarming Podcast, mocking the illiterate since 2015.
So, another game that we came across that really goes hard on the iconography, and I think this is more for the sake of saving real estate, but maybe there are people out there who really like what they did with it, is Race for the Galaxy.
Ooh.
And I will admit that I gave this game one chance and not another one after that.
Okay, so our game of Race for the Galaxy. Gary was so pumped to bring over Race for the Galaxy. This was shortly after we all... I came down from the frigid white north where I had been for some time wrestling polar bears and, mm-hmm. you know, beating one another with willow boughs in a sauna.
That's how people from the north say sauna.
Not willow.
Yeah.
Damn. But anyway, I just come back and we were all hanging about and we were getting into board games pretty thick. We're playing a lot of Arkham at the time and starting to look out and buy more. And Gary's all pumped. He's like, oh, we're getting into games. I've got Race for the Galaxy. I'll bring it over. You guys will love it. It'll be a lot of fun. And so we're like, yeah, Gary, bring it on over. We'll play. And so he brings it over, and he tries to teach it, and it's rough. We have a rough go of learning it.
Yeah.
And Race for the Galaxy is not a forgiving game. It's first time out. I feel like if we had given it more chances and learned its iconography better,
mm-hmm.
it would have been pretty good. But that first game was just so brutal in terms of figuring out what those icons meant and remembering them
mm-hmm.
that Johannes has throat punched people for even saying the words race and galaxy in the same verbal paragraph.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bad. It was a bad time.
They don't even need to bring up four and the. Just race and galaxy.
I mentioned before, I don't have any brain space for memorizing iconography like that. It just it was a few years back, so I don't remember very well, but as I recall, the iconography in Race for the Galaxy doesn't distinguish itself very well.
I truly don't remember.
It's not like all of the icons are on every card, so you can figure, and just with a value, you know, there's none of this icon. They're just like, maybe they're on there, maybe they're not. Figure out what they are. There's no words.
And it had a player mat that was like a reference.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of reference.
Yeah. So we had a rough time with that. I think I made this comparison to you guys. This is just like, this is the most nerdy, like far out of field, no one else will get it, a reference. But it's like I play piano, and I used to use this old 80s Yamaha KX88 keyboard controller. It was a MIDI controller. And Yamaha had this brilliant idea that they were going to simplify the MIDI controller by having as few buttons as possible. And so you could interface with everything you would need to do with normally like dozens of buttons and knobs with, I think there were 12 buttons on the thing, just in different combinations. Ooh. And so they were trying to simplify it, but what it meant instead was you had to just memorize everything to know how to do. So you basically, you couldn't use the thing if you didn't have a manual in front of you to constantly go back and reference what you thought those button combinations were.
That's really interesting that you bring up that example, because it kind of ties into a problem we ran into in a design we were working on recently, or rather that I was working on and trying to get you to care about.
Yeah.
When I was working on the spell system for that pen and paper, I had designed this system for casting spells in a pen and paper RPG that I was working on. And my thought had been, I want to make this customizable and flexible and relatively straightforward so that it's not going to take, it's not like D&D where it takes up 2/3 of the rule book just to list all the spells you can cast. So I created a list of like 8 or 10 different spell components and rules for combining them to create spells. By putting two of them together, you get a different spell. And I created some rules for how to work it and how they interact with another one. And it wound up, you could do like several hundred spells with different combinations. But when I showed it to Johannes, he was like, this is the most convoluted and confusing thing you have ever written in your entire life. And, you know, looking back, and I'm like, yeah, I can see how until you got over the hump and had memorized a bunch of ways that it interacted and had that idea down, it would look just horrifying, even more horrifying than having a couple hundred pages of just, here's a spell you can cast. Here's a different spell that happens to be designed on the same principles as the first one, but works a little bit differently.
Well, it was kind of like the game, we played a game called Magicka, which was a cooperative multiplayer computer game, you know, couch co-op, you're all on the, sharing a screen. And in that game, you crafted spells by combining, was it 4 elements or something?
There were more than 4, but they were elements, basically.
But it wasn't that many of them, because you had to be able to make them with your control stick. I think it was only 4.
Well, there was, I don't remember.
But there were 4 elements, but you could have up to like 8 in a spell or something.
Something like that, yeah.
So there were a lot of spell combinations available, because you could go, you know, fire, 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 or you could go fire, rock, whatever, like
earth, wind, water, fire, heart.
It was something like that.
Go planet.
Yeah. So
and planeteers.
Yeah. Shut up now. So even that was a lot to try to get your head around, and that was a lot more simple, I think, than what you came up with. And you're doing it constantly, right? Like basically, you don't learn the spells; you learn the combination of movements with the right control stick on your controller to hack these things out. And it still took us a while to get them down. And we didn't memorize the book of spells, because you could always flip through a reference, but you're sitting there getting hammered on by bad guys trying to find your spell. So you just memorized the 3 or 4 that worked the best for you. And we're like, all right, these are the ones I know; those are the ones I'm going to use. Hopefully, I don't need anything else. So that same sort of button combination or element combination thing, trying to save space, we're getting way off the making it accessible and inclusive track, but you know, it can work. But I think in creating your the temptation is to go way further out into number of combinations or number of sure. elements that you're combining before it's actually way too much for someone who isn't the person who designed the game in the first place.
Right, right. Well, I think that to tie it back into inclusivity, it's a kind of I am neck deep in the design process blindness that you can get where yeah. you understand it because you've been staring at the spreadsheet for 14 hours as you put everything together. Then when you show it to somebody else, they're like, what happened?
Yeah.
What did you do?
What even is this?
Are you okay? Just sit down. I'm going to call the nice men and they're going to take you away to a quiet room where it'll all be all right. You know, you get so deep into that you don't, it's difficult to think about how would a different person that isn't me and isn't this invested in it think about it. And designing your game to be inclusive is the same way. How would a person who sees color differently interact with what I've built?
Or who doesn't see at all.
Or who doesn't see at all, or who doesn't speak my language. Or even on an even more basic level, who hasn't played a bunch of board games. I mean, how many of us...
Yeah, that's right. We're to use your terminology, neck deep in being sighted, English-speaking, reasonably well-educated white men who can hear. Mm-hmm.
And who play a lot of board games.
Yeah.
So how many of the things we're designing are predicated on this person has played enough board games to know what I mean by this term? Like if I throw out the term D6 in a book, in a rule book, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Many of our readers might know what I mean. But if I try to show that to just like some random person on the street, they're going to be like, what's a D6?
Yeah.
They might not know what that means. So just being sure that your game considers that broader audience is probably good.
It's the letter D on your sixth iteration through the alphabet. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Glad we're on the same page.
What else would it possibly mean?
For my mom, when you listen to this episode, a D6 is a die with six sides.
Yeah, because it's, yeah.
On the same note, you know, a D20 is a die with 20 sides and so on and so forth.
Right. And a D pi is a die with...
Like one side is apple and one side is peach. And
yeah.
One is like a pecan pie.
Dude, I could do some berry pie right about
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
Be good. Or some fiesta pie wouldn't be bad.
It's not a real thing.
It's real.
It isn't.
You've had it. You've eaten it with your mouth.
I don't believe
you were,
that it's real.
I saw you take a fistful off of your plate
and just smear it on my face.
And cram it into your slavering craw like some sort of animal.
There's no such thing as fiesta pie.
Google it.
Tom made it up.
I did not. Make it up. It's real, and it's delicious.
But it is inclusive in that it is a lie, whether or not you can see, hear, speak, smell, taste, or walk.
It's inclusive in that it's delicious, regardless of whether you can see, hear, smell, or walk. If you can't taste, I can't.
Yeah,
there's not much you can do there.
Not so delicious.
I'm sorry. It's not inclusive of you.
I think it becomes about texture. That's what I'm told. I actually know a guy who can't taste.
Really?
Yeah, it seems rough, but he's okay with it, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's better than being not okay with it. Doesn't sound like there's a lot he can do about it.
I guess that's true.
On the plus side, taste rarely comes up in board games, so...
Hopefully not often.
He's probably okay there.
As you're trying to lick off the beer that you spilled on the rule book without the guy who owns the game noticing?
Yeah, that never happens. It's like you could have like a scratch and taste card. You scratch God. Off the stuff and then you lick it. And
then you shuffle it back into the deck for the next person.
This one was pineapple. That means I do 8 points of damage.
Speaking of things that are hard to memorize, the value of pineapple is 8.
Yeah, what else would it be?
14?
No, that doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
It's pineapple. Pineapple is 8. This is obvious, dude.
There's some race out in the galaxy that we haven't, some alien species we haven't encountered yet that primarily interacts with like number values through taste. And in 1,000 years, they'll hear this and be deeply offended. And then they'll travel back in time and probably harm us somehow. We'll be punished, rest assured.
It seems like if this is a just universe, that will have to happen at some point.
At least once.
You said there's a race somewhere out in the galaxy.
Yeah,
I thought you were about to make a race for the galaxy joke.
Punch myself in the throat.
Yeah, exactly. So we've talked about color blindness. We talked about regular blindness. We talked about language. Are there any other, do you think, disabilities or difficulties or differences among people that you would want to consider as you're designing a board game? Like any other things that might make playing... your standard issue board game difficult for folks that we could design around and make easier?
I think there probably are something you have to ask is how are people going to interact with your game? Like, we talked about the different styles of player that you're likely to encounter playing mm-hmm. games, and how and if you should design around them and those styles of play. And to some degree, I think it might be similar. Like, how often is this a thing? And is it a thing that needs to be overcome by design, or does it need to be overcome by the group of people who are playing? You could be playing, you know, there are people who only have one hand or who have no hands, and you could probably design a board game for them, and that might be cool. Or you might hamper a board game that could have been better if you didn't just rely on them having friends to play it with them who are willing to move their pieces for them.
Yeah,
or
so
someone who can hold their hand of cards. Or another designer or, you know, people who make a product to hold a hand of cards on the arm of a wheelchair or something. You know, like, just as an example,
mm-hmm.
there are probably things to design around. And, of course, every person is worth designing for. But the question is, where do you, I don't want to say draw the line, but, you know, how many of them do you have to design for before you're harming the game that they may have been able to interact with in a different way if you hadn't designed around a projected problem that a player might have? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't have an answer, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
But the record will show that we are deeply dumb men. And so if you have any suggestions, hit us up at our various contact points and, you know, let us know, because we're stupid and we don't know things.
And if we used any terminology wrong for differently abled people, or if we completely overlooked an obvious one, please very kindly let us know. I assure you it was not intentional. It was just us being dumb and mean and bad. No, it was just us forgetting or maybe not knowing, like we talked about. It's just a blind spot because of who we are and where we are. So please hit us up on Twitter at @mildlyalarming.
Shoot us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com. And you can now also leave a comment on our Facebook page for the Mildly Alarming podcast.
And we will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
The Mildly Alarming podcast is brought to you by
Jeremy's Own brand paper towels. With Jeremy's Own, you don't have to worry about whether or not these paper towels belong to you. They don't. They're Jeremy's, and he wants them back. Jeremy's Own brand paper towels. They belong to Jeremy, so give them back.
So, on the break, I was thinking about how we went through such pains to speak, you know, inclusively and politely about the differently abled and the disabled and the whatnot, and then you proceeded to refer to our lack of knowledge about a particular disability as a blind spot.
Yeah, that wasn't on purpose. It really wasn't.
I just felt like I should bring that up and point out that you're a villain. You are a villain.
Honestly, admitting that we were taking great pains to try to be politically correct is probably kind of tipping our hand, because I'm sure we weren't very good at it.
No, probably not.
But we did try, really. We're so sorry.
We tried, and therefore no one should criticize us.
Is that how that works?
Sure. At least according to... who's the guy who looks like Elijah Wood but isn't?
I have no idea.
The other guy, he played the Harry Potters.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so on to the second half of the podcast where our blood alcohol content rises and therefore the topic shifts into incoherent nonsense. What do you got for us?
And we're going to make fun of one of our friend's disability.
God, the gin went right up my nose.
It's funny because it's not entirely untrue. So a friend of ours has a lot of allergies, and I don't mean just like hay fever, like food and drug allergies. And he learned today what his official list of things he's actually allergic to are. And I was just so overwhelmed by this list when he sent it to me that I really kind of wanted to just talk a little bit about what a horrible, or, you know, interesting, you could make the best of it, but I wouldn't, life that might create. So here is the list. This is the first time Tom is hearing this.
I have not heard it before.
It's pretty intense. Here we go. In, I believe, alphabetical order. Amaranth.
Not an order of severity?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Amaranth. Banana.
Wait, hold on. You're going to have to back up already. What is amaranth?
I think it's a type of spice. Can you look it up?
I'll look up amaranth. Okay.
Because I'm not even sure. Amaranth, banana, beans, green beans, lima beans.
You're going to have to back up there. Why are we breaking down the different types of beans?
I think this is actually how it was tested, because there are also some things on here that are dairy, but also dairy is listed. So, okay. Like, there are, like, some cheeses or milk or whatever, but then dairy is, I think dairy is listed, but casein, which is a protein, and, like, whey, which is a protein.
Casein was a guy we went to high school with.
Both.
Okay.
Yes. He probably would be a reasonable source of protein were you to, like, barbecue him.
I suppose, yeah, that's probably true. He wasn't a really big guy, if I remember right.
No, but still.
Enough, you know, I guess, yeah.
People are generally made of protein.
Amaranthus, collectively known as amaranth, is a cosmopolitan genus of annual or short-lived perennial plants. Some amaranth species are cultivated as leaf vegetables, cereals, and ornamental plants.
Anything. It's a thing.
It sounded like it covered a lot of ground there, yeah.
Yeah, it did.
Approximately 60 species are recognized, so he's going to have to study up.
All right, so I'm going to try this one more time. I'm just going to get through the list. If you have more questions, write them down.
Hold on, I gotta open a new WordPad file.
All right, get on that.
All right,
because I'm starting from the top.
All right, I'm ready. Okay.
All right, amaranth.
I'm gonna.
God. Amaranth. I'm just gonna have a long recording of me saying amaranth a bunch of different ways.
You know, amaranth. The funny thing is, you have complete control over my microphone.
Yeah, I know. Amaranth, banana, beans, green beans, lima beans, pinto beans. Red beans, Brazil nuts, capsicum, casein, cashew, chickpeas, coffee, cottonseed, cranberry, eggs, ginger, hazelnut, honey, lentils, licorice, orange. Is orange separate? Is there a. Hold on. Orange. Just orange. The color. Parsley.
He's like the Green Lantern,
yeah.
Except orange instead of yellow.
Yeah. Parsley, peanuts, cayenne pepper, pineapple, pistachio, poppy seed, pumpkin quinoa. Yes, those are one thing, not pumpkins and quinoa. Pumpkin quinoa, I believe, anyway. Sesame, soy, strawberry, sunflower seed, whey, white bean, and yeast.
I have some questions.
Yeah, I did too.
should I just start at the top of my list?
Take it away.
What the hell is a Brazil nut?
You don't know what a Brazil nut is?
I don't know what a Brazil nut is.
I think they exist explicitly to be put in those holiday mixed nut things that, like, your boss gives you because he has to give you something.
My boss gave me a pen holder.
Yeah, your boss... I don't know. Was that good or bad?
It was fine. I put my pens in it.
Still, you just work for a little longer. Eventually, you'll get something that contains a Brazil nut. If I remember correctly, they're gigantic and they don't really taste that good. Or like anything.
Okay. Coffee. Now...
Coffee is sort of a cherry. And there's... Mm-hmm. Is that what you're asking?
No. My question was going to be... We had this friend over at my home on recently.
Yeah.
And I gave him a cup of coffee that he drank, and he didn't swell up and die.
Yeah, so there are different severities here, and I think he's being told, probably don't have these because you reacted to them on some level, and with most allergies, if you continue to just have that thing, you can make it worse, because it's basically an immune response.
Gotcha.
So he hasn't seen anything from, like, eggs don't really cause him any trouble right now.
Mm-hmm.
A few other things... don't either, but
They might.
They're like, just don't do that
now
anymore.
This is a good conversation, thinking back to our discussion of how ignorant we are earlier on in the night, because you are allergic to everything that grows, as I recall, or that was once growing.
Yeah.
Whereas I am allergic to, as far as we know, more or less nothing.
Right.
So I'm pretty ignorant about what an allergy is or how it functions, whereas you are intimately familiar with things that would make you swell up and die.
Sure. Well, my understanding, because I've seen a lot of different people react a lot of different ways to things, and some people, like dairy is one of those allergies that, first of all, you could be reacting to any number of things in dairy. There's a few different proteins, and there's some other stuff. So, like, I was allergic to whey, which is the thin, like, liquid part of...
The kind of ropey part in milk?
No. No, the not ropey part in milk. Thin liquid and not like a rope at all.
So it's not like the thick, like lengthy chunks that float in the milk and kind of curl around your tongue as you try to drink it?
What kind? That's so disgusting. Tom only drinks octopus milk, which has tentacles in it.
There's another kind? Listen, there seems to be a lot of things I don't know and that I'm learning tonight.
Yeah, apparently. So, but basic, at their basis level, as I understand it, an allergy is your body's immune system deciding that something that isn't really a problem is a problem, and reacting to attack that thing as though it were a foreign invader rather than like something you wanted to pour on your cereal and enjoy for breakfast in the morning, like gorilla milk.
Right, gorilla milk, yeah.
So... it can make you sneeze. It can make you swell up. The sort of typical allergic reaction is a lot like a cold. But then, like, some people break out in hives. Some people get a rash. Some people's throats close up and they stop breathing. And there are other, you know, other different ways that you can react to these things. And then with different severities as well. So our friend gets really sick to his stomach when he has dairy or gluten. But that doesn't necessarily even mean that that's the same reaction he would have to all these other things. And some of them he's had no reaction to other than small enough one that it could be measured on this test.
Gotcha. I wrote down honey as one that I was confused about only because I had heard, and this is going to sound racist, but I heard from an old Arabic man that it was like a cure-all, and it was like really super incredibly good for you, and that honey was like, go honey. And then I had looked it up on the internet more, and it turns out the internet agreed with this elderly man that I chatted with.
So honey has a lot of antimicrobial properties. It's basically like a naturally occurring antibiotic almost, and it's also supposed to actually help with your allergies. It will help with some allergies.
But not like, an allergy to itself, probably.
Apparently not. But like pollen allergies, generally. And so local honey, for instance, is supposed to be better for... Like honey that is from the area where you live is supposed to be more effective for you. So it is the case. In fact, it's such a potent antimicrobial, you're not supposed to give it to young children because they're still developing their... natural flora, and it can really muck with babies and small children.
You don't want to muck with babies.
But so I learned this today talking to our friend about his absurd list of things to which he is allergic. Apparently, you can get a false positive for a honey allergy if you are also allergic to bee venom, which he happens to be. He already knew he had a bee allergy.
Fair enough.
Let's go. What's next on your list?
I wrote down cayenne pepper, but I think I wrote that down for the same reason as coffee, because there was cayenne pepper in the chili.
Yeah, but there's also beans in the chili.
Oh, like a couple different types.
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably should have died.
Yeah. So those probably aren't super severe. Let's get through the list so we can talk about...
The last one I have is pumpkin quinoa.
I don't know what that is. I like to think that it's a quinoa, which is like sort of like a little... Sort of... It's a cereal grain, I think, but it's like high in protein.
Doesn't it like look like a rice, but it's like a little sphere instead of a little tube?
Yeah, I like to think that a pumpkin quinoa is either bright orange or like the size of a basketball.
It's a quinoa, but huge.
Yeah.
I wrote that down because I didn't know what a quinoa was off the top of my head, but I knew how to spell it.
Quinoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I only knew how to spell it because Nick Offerman mocked people who know how to pronounce quinoa in his Netflix special.
Yeah.
And I saw it in the subtitles.
Okay.
That's why I know how to spell quinoa, ladies and gentlemen. Right.
So the thing I found entertaining about this, other than the just tremendously long list of
How does he make it through the day?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I ask that a lot because he's, you know,
our friend.
Yeah, he would willingly associate with us. So clearly, he has some sort of issue in the brain yellow region.
Yeah,
he's dumb, is what I'm saying.
But so, what would it be like? You know, like you're allergic to everything now. Just you can't.
What food can he eat, like, really, anymore?
I guess meat.
Because, like, much of what I put in the chili that I made is bad, I guess.
Like, tomatoes and, yeah, so your chili, a chili safe for our friend would be made of...
Tomatoes.
And meat.
And like, some of the spices, maybe.
Maybe.
You'd have to get rid of the cayenne pepper, I think it mentioned.
Yeah.
Maybe the black pepper just to be safe.
Yeah, like, as long as it's not somehow in the apparently incredibly broad amaranth family, who knows?
Yeah, let's look back at amaranth, see what that covers.
It sounds like some, like...
Hold on, let's roll on down.
Some Dungeons and Dragons spell components.
Or like, you know, you would get your quests from the wizard Amaranth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Let's see here. Amaranth's human uses are, I mean, you use the seed, you can make flour, it looks like. Leaves, you can use the leaves, the roots, and the stems. You can make a dye out of it.
Like a buffalo, because you can use all of it.
Yeah, that's what it's like. It's like a, oh my god. They're raised as a grain in Asia and in the Americas. The seeds are a good source of protein. It's easy to cook. You can make flour out of it. Did I mention that already? Whatever.
I don't listen when you talk.
Anyway, he could be eating amaranth, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, in fact, it seems likely, but he can't now.
He shouldn't.
He really ought not.
He should avoid the amaranth. So basically, he can eat, like, sloppy joes, is what this is boiling
down.
No,
because a sloppy joe is
right.
On a bun
it's on
and
a bun.
Probably contains something like chili powder.
Really? Like, I thought a sloppy joe was just, like, ketchup and ground beef.
Oh, it might be ketchup. I don't know. I don't eat sloppy joes because they're bad. They're an unfood.
Communist.
But, yeah, so...
I don't... Was gluten on there?
No, so he wasn't tested for gluten or dairy because...
We already knew that.
Or no, he was tested for dairy. He wasn't tested for gluten because in order to be tested for these things, you have to eat them. And he was just like, no, I am not doing that. I already know what happens.
That's so awful, but I'm just imagining him sitting there taking a little bit and then just suffering.
Yeah.
And it's just awful for him.
So if you're already fasting from whatever they're testing you from, they can't get a reasonable test.
Mm-hmm. So they don't know for sure that he's allergic to gluten, but he's allergic to gluten.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not on paper.
So pretty much he can eat, like, steak with no... Just by itself.
Yeah,
no,
which is the best way to cook steak.
No spices or side dishes.
But it gets expensive pretty quick, probably, if all you can eat is steak.
But if all you are eating is steak, I mean, you're saving all that money on beans. Listen, my bean budget is the third highest budget in my household.
Yeah.
It's why it smells so funny in here. So now we've mocked our friend for being allergic to all sorts of things. And made a lengthy, elaborate, cackling joke out of his imminent death when he comes across some fucking amaranth he didn't know about. Mildly Alarming Podcast, mocking you for your health problems since 2015. Classy as hell.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add to
us? I thought we were going to go more in a direction of, like, what would it be like if you were allergic? You know, like, what if you were allergic to sunlight? Apparently that's actually a thing. How do you live your life? But we spent so much time going over the list that I planned to just blow through quickly to set up the segment.
Well,
that
I had some questions.
Apparently you did, yeah.
I needed to know about amaranth.
So there we have Brazil nuts. Unnamed friend.
No, wait, we got to back up to this list again, though.
Okay.
So, they tested him for amaranth, and that's weird to me to begin with.
It must be common enough to be, A, worth testing, and B, that he would have consumed it recently enough that it would show up on the test.
But I thought they gave him, like, a sample of each one.
No, they don't give it to you.
Oh! So they just test what your body's reacting to?
So, there's an older allergy test where they basically, the scratch test,
mm-hmm.
where they, like, on your back, scratch you a little bit, and then expose you to various things and
I've
see
seen
how you react
when,
to them.
When I was working at the other hospital that I don't work at anymore, one of the nurses, I think, showed me a picture of that, and like they draw like a tic-tac-toe grid
on exactly.
You, and they scratch you with your whatever they think you might be allergic to in each of the boxes, and then they check that later to see if you're swelling up.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Medicine, that's not what this was. As I understand it,
crazy.
This was a, as I understand it, this was a blood panel. And so you already have to have had those things in your system. And I don't know what they're checking. Mm-hmm. If it's your white blood cell.
Sure.
What type of lymphocytes were created or whatever. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that was going to be my question then is like, why would you check for Brazil nuts? Or like, why do they check for these particular things and have them come back? Like, how do they compile that list?
Well, given the comprehensiveness of this list, they probably take all of the things that they have encountered an allergy to in the past and just test for it, because mm-hmm. it's not the scratch test, so it's just against a blood sample, so it's not like you're
sure.
necessarily making this person's life worse by testing for it. Where if you tried to test, even the number that came back here, like, he doesn't have enough space on his back for a scratch test, including just the ones that came back positive.
It's like a 10 by 10 grid back there. It's stretching around onto his chest. Oh, poor.
Yes, poor that person.
Did I say his name?
Yes.
Damn it.
And then you said, and now I have to censor that.
It's just farm noises all the way down.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm always disappointed that when we do slip up and swear, which we do entirely too frequently, it's always really short, one-syllable words. Because really, the chicken noise is the only one that can cover it. And I've got some other good farm animal noises.
So you're saying you're looking for us to say things like and slowly so that you can put a longer noise over it. So it'd be more like.
Yeah, yeah. Or like something even longer so I could get the whole like of a horse neighing. Like.
Or I mean, it doesn't even necessarily have to be like a curse. Like I could just say something like, and you could just censor that. And
that's
now,
disgusting. I can't believe you said that.
I know, right? And now the readers are wondering what I said there.
They're still listeners.
They're still listeners, are they, huh?
Or everything is reading.
Everything is reading. And on that note,
we failed to offend you in the first half, but have managed to offend you in the second half. Please let us know how so we can apologize to you.
We're so sorry.
On Twitter, at Mildly Alarming.
Send us an email to mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or in the comments section on our website at www.mildlyalarming.com.
You can also contact us via Morse code, if you want.
We won't. Neither of us knows Morse code.
But they could if they wanted to. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
The Mildly Alarming Podcast is a co-production of WTF, Altarian Public Media, and Mildly Alarming Productions. This episode was produced by Johanna Stauffer and mixed by Johanna Stauffer. Our producers include Johanna Stauffer, Johanna Stauffer, and me, Johanna Stauffer. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or find our RSS feed at www.mildlyalarming.com.
What are you doing?
Oh,